go out, grab a cup of tea, and come back so that we start with 5 minutes behind time already. There was no tea before, that's why I'm announcing it now. We're waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting, so it has finally arrived. Some of my colleagues are still on their way. Others have this or that workshop to attend, but however, we felt that we need to interact, get it done with, and I think that the same would apply, that in relation to this morning, we need to continue. And I hope that you all have copies of the program with us. And would like to welcome the officials from Sandy. Welcome. And also the officials from the Department of Labor, the acting DG, and your team, welcome. And also from National Treasury, as well as the Auditor General's Office, as always, welcome. We had communicated, and I think our program says so as well, that we're going to start with somebody, and then finish it off with the Department of Labor. Would allow you from somebody to introduce yourself. And I think from there, let's also allow the Department of Labor, because I mean, we're all here. And then National Treasury, the AG's office, and then members of the committee to do the same, so that we can then start with our business. Yeah.
Thanks very much, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. Our team is, I'm the Director General of SAMDI, shortly to be the Public Sector Academy. I'm Mark Hawkins. With me, I've got Rufus Matlana, who's the Deputy Director General of our big line department of Organizational Development and Training Services. Ms. Marilee Turfendurt, our Acting CFO. Dr. D.P. van der Nest, who is the chairperson of our audit committee, and then on the side, Ms. Brenda Barnard, who manages the office of the DG. Thank you, Colin.
Thank you very much. Department of Labor.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Les Kettle, that's Acting Director General for the Department of Labor. I have with me Chris van der Merwe, the Chief Financial Officer, Ms. Sianda Zondeki, the Deputy Director General for Service Delivery in the Department, Mr. Len Larson, the Acting CEO for the Sheltered Employment Factories, Advocate Pasha, the Acting Deputy Director General for Corporate Services, Mr. Ganga Tengiwe, Senior Executive Manager for Human Resource Management, Mr. Sam Morotoba, the Deputy Director General for Employment and Skills Development Services in the Department, and Mr. Jeffrey Dupre, the Senior Executive Manager responsible for the National Skills Fund. Thank you, Jefferson.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Honorable Chair. George Tembo from the National Treasury, Program Manager for SAMDI at the National Treasury.
Thank you, Chair. Reza Achar, National Treasury.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm Judy Nider from Social Services at National Treasury.
Thank you very much.
Chair Barry Weather from the Auditor General's Office, Business Executive responsible for portfolio of audits, of which Sampley is one of them. Thank you, Chair.
You can just turn, switch the mic on.
Thank you, Honorable Chairman. Musa Chongwa, the Senior Manager responsible for Zambi from the Auditor General's Office.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Mason Kau, Auditor General, Department of Labor Portfolio.
Thank you, Chair. And Keith Kalikan, Senior Manager, Department of Labor.
Thank you very much. Can we have members introducing themselves, starting at the extreme right?
Martin Stevens, member of SCOPA.
Eddie Chase, SCOPA.
Trevor Bonham, SCOPA.
Pierre John Herbert, SCOPA.
Thank you very much, Comrade Herbert Godi. I chair the committee. Right. I will hand over as per our program to Comrade Bonhoff.
Good morning, everyone. I think we start off with a nice, good note. It's a lovely, clean report was given for the first time. And the Auditor General's remarks are quite good, I must say. But there is a few things that need to be sorted out and to be cleaned up with. I think there is vast improvement in the department itself. I have not many questions, a few. The first one, you know, I want to talk about is the vote. And it says that internal controls over fixed assets and be consistently found to be weak in the auditors. In the year 6 and 7, the Auditor General reported that there was inadequate monitoring of controls, which resulted in the understatement of 753,000 rand. And in the year 05 and 06, an emphasis matter was raised by the AG on insufficient controls over the internal movement of assets and the timely updating of the assets register. What has SAMDI done to address these weaknesses?
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. If I could just take 10 seconds before picking up the first question, just to indicate some acknowledgements on our side, Chair, if I may, that as seen in the introduction, we have with us our colleagues from the Auditor General's Office, our Audit Chair from Treasury. Of course, we also meet the Portfolio Committee, and so for us to complete that pattern by getting acquainted with SCOPA is very valuable, and we do appreciate your including us in the program. I'd also mention, just by way of background, we know that, or at least it's not the SCOPA procedure, we did prepare some background material on our related issues, governance, and so on. And if colleagues, Chair, if you wish, this can be distributed to colleagues simply to lodge in the back of their file. In particular, time may well not permit us to talk about our current transformation, but there are a few slides in the back of the presentation that people may wish to look at. In another context, which deal with the changes in SAMDI. So, Chair, with your permission, the document can be given out, or perhaps people may wish to take it for filing when we leave.
Yeah, no. If you have it handy, yes, it can be given out. There's no problem. But maybe let's move to
the gist of his question.
On the question, Chair, thank you. We would first note by way of background that there are no repeated matters from the previous annual report and financial.
Is your mic on?
Yeah, but I'm not talking into it properly.
Let it be on and talk to it.
Yeah, right.
Talk it to it. Yeah.
Thanks, Honourable Chair. So we firstly note that the matter from the previous year, 05-06, regarding assets, is a different one from 06-07. We're pleased to be able to report there are no continuing matters that were unresolved from a past year to the next. The assets issue referred to by the Honourable Member arises as follows, that in the cash system which applies to the vote, the Auditor General prefers us to put items onto the assets register as they are purchased. Our practice had been to add them to the register as they arrived. So the particular amount concerned the purchase which was made in the financial year and only arrived in the following financial year and therefore wasn't included in the register, but now advised by the AG we'll be following their practice and adding items to the register as they are purchased. In addition, we've increased the seniority of the people handling the assets register.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yes,
thank you.
Director, the training trade in the accounts. Internal controls over revenue and receivables for the year 607, the AG identified unallocated receipts amounting to 740,840 rand. And in the year 5 and year 6, the AG raised emphasis on the matter because of weaknesses found in the internal controls over the completeness of the revenue and accounts receivables. What measures have we put in place to ensure that the above weaknesses are eliminated?
Thank you. On this issue, happily the two matters were separate. In other words, it wasn't a lack of attention to the one that's been picked up in the other. In the earlier matter, the AG was correctly identifying that we didn't yet have in place a computerized system to handle the many bookings of court events and the associated issuing of invoices and statements. In the more recent issue, the problem is that in the large variety of people to whom we render services, we receive payments in a number of ways. The internet payments are not problematic, but payments by check are sometimes inadequately identified by the people who supply them to us. Now, the amount of unallocated receipts, 740,000 there, honourable members, actually represents our solution to the problem. In other words, we took about 800,000 of unallocated amounts and brought them down to about 80,000 in the course of the audit preparation. But we only completed this improvement as matters were underway, so this amount reflects successful allocations but only accomplished just after the audit date. Now, what we've put in place to handle that, firstly, we've arranged with our bank a rather neat, more modern facility where we get images of both sides of the check now, so that there's more information to see who has sent it to us. We've also commissioned extra lines of detail on our bank statement to be able to identify who's paying us. and that computerized court system that I mentioned from as a solution to the previous year's problem, that now provides an independent basis of reconciliation.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Spoken on receivables. The Auditor General also expressed concern over the timeless collection of debts and the compliance with the statements of the general acceptance accounting practices. Could you please try and give us an idea on the following questions? What has been done to ensure timeless collection of the debtors? And you note on page 132 of the annual report on note 15, debtors amounting to 4.3 million are outstanding for longer than 1 year. Are these still collectible, and why are they outstanding for so long? Next one is, does this weakness, timeless collections, have an impact on cash flow for the claiming entity? Then why were debtors received amounting to 740,000 840 not allocated, and why did Sunbeam not comply with the accounting statements IAS 39 in the first place? Oops, sorry.
Thanks. Honourable Member, was indeed a problem which, in fact, I had to address very promptly after joining the organisation. The previous issues were in fact solutions underway that I inherited. But in this particular case, coming from a different environment, where I've been in the HSRC, where we had to run a much more cash flow conscious organization, I did notice the problem that the Honourable Member had pointed out to. And in this case, it was a lack of a suitable modern technology. The debts, and in particular the historical debts, were on a manual system. So we moved very rapidly to introduce an automated system which would bring this under control and also allow broad analysis of the aging of the debt, and thereby allow us to put people onto very active following up with the CFOs or, if necessary, the DGs of people who owed us money over a historical time. So in the year under review, we only really had the last 3 or 4 months, I started in October, to put that system in, do the analysis, and get some debt chasing underway. But in fact, that was quite successful. We brought in perhaps a third of the long-standing historical debt of about 20-odd million, and then continued that in the subsequent financial year that of 07-08. So that matter has been brought in hand, and in fact, you will probably have noticed elsewhere in the financials that the reason, or half the reason for our now having a surplus in our trading account is because of improved debt recovery. So I think that I hope handled the first part of the question, but the Honourable Member also notes that with regard to debt of this kind, there was the accounting standard IAS 39. Now, because we ourselves did not charge interest to our fellow government departments for their debt, I mean, we may yet get there, Chair, but we don't think it makes the service provider very popular. So, because we weren't ourselves charging debt, we hadn't thought that IAS 39 was applicable to us. But the AG brought this to our attention, that one has to discount historical debt. As the value of the money concerned drops under inflation, we're now applying that procedure. It gets a little complicated because of changes of interest rate over the period, so we've installed a computer program and are running that to keep us compliant. And as a result, the year-end debt is down from 24 million to 7 million rand. As for impact on cash flow, of course, it did have an impact from an accounting perspective, but that's, we believe, Chair, one of the purposes of working under a trading account, that you have a bit of a buffer from your historical surplus. That's no excuse for cash flow inefficiency, but it did save us from getting into trouble, and now I think we've introduced the efficiency and will steadily wipe out the debt. In the case of the oldest debt, Chair, if we were in the commercial context, we would be dealing with our auditors and our principals about writing off debt. But I understand that doesn't occur in government, so unfortunately in some cases things which would elsewhere be written off now remain on our books, but in effect they're ring-fenced by the new procedures. They're covered by our surplus, so they don't represent a problem. Jeff, just in a previous life, I did actually go to law to attempt to recover an appreciable historical debt, and very nearly found myself in the embarrassing situation of owning the BMW and the library computers of a recalcitrant university. Now, that would have been even more problem for us than them, but luckily they paid up. We haven't had to go down that road yet in terms of...
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Orkin. On payables, the Auditor General found that there was inadequate monitoring of controls to ensure the completeness of payables. What improvements, if any, have we effected in this regard? And is somebody paying the creditors within 30 days as required by the Treasury regulations?
Chair, luckily this was just a single incident, Honourable Member. We'd actually been quite rich. A supplier invoiced us rather late for a service for which we had successfully invoiced the receiving party and already been paid. So that payable was because of a slow supplier rather than ourselves. But what we are being sure to do, since most of our users are fellow departments, the annual interdepartmental letters, which are exchanged near all the time, by which each department tells each other who owes what, we'll be going through those more closely each time to try and avoid another isolated incident of this kind.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Orkin. In capacity, on page 142 of the annual report, I was found the trading account shows a vacancy rate of 24.4% in year 05-06, but it was 24%. Why do you have such a high vacancy rate? Does this not impact negatively on the trading account performance?
Chair, I think the Honourable Member is asking us whether we have stopped beating our husbands or wives. It is an appreciable vacancy rate. We believe it's approximately average, but in the case of Sandian this year, it's also something we are achieving deliberately, because our mandate when I took office was to plan and then implement the transition to an academy to achieve a much larger availability of training opportunities for the public service. And so pending that restructuring, we deliberately didn't fill vacancies so that they could form part of the advertisements for the new institution. So by that way, in effect, one minimizes the pain of an organizational restructuring. But even with not filling vacancies as they arose, we didn't rise to a level which compromised our performance. And in particular, we made use, or have been making use, of short-term assignment people pending the advertisement, which will occur in February as we populate the new organogram.
All right. Just a minute, Kumbis. Honorable Chen, you wanted to make a follow-up on anything?
I understand your logic, but you know what always concerns me, because we hear a lot about this, these are a team of funded firms. Okay, now therefore they're part of your budget. So therefore your budget's not right. This concerns me, because it happens quite a lot, you know, that the partners tell us, well, you know, we don't need these people. But, you know, it doesn't create a good impression in respect of the accuracy of your budgeting. It's almost like you're sort of putting away a little bit of, reserve there. And then that does concern us, because that is replicated all over government, you know. There's a lot of money lying there supposed to be used for some purpose which is not being used for that purpose, and thereby denying other service delivery in other areas. And I think that is a concern that's what concerns us. I just wanted to make that point. Maybe you would like to comment on that.
Sure, we'd agree with the point. In our case, I think we argue it is a matter of temporary phasing, that really we have been very strongly encouraged to exercise our vigorous mandate of transformation. And so the situation, as the Honourable Member correctly described, is temporary. And as we get up to the increased staffing that is in our strategy and new organogram for the enhanced deliverables, we'll certainly be moving back towards using all of our funded posts for the correct amount. To the extent we do show some savings for this period of holding posts empty deliberately for a few months, that will be also usefully applied to the extra costs of staffing a new institution, of interviewing and holding temporary people.
Thank you.
Just the last, the final question is, does the restructuring of Sandy, keep your public service academy on track?
Thanks, Chair. Yes, it's a complicated and I would add a difficult process in the context of the public service, with its ambitious range of frameworks and regulations to be complied with. So I will say that I've handled restructuring in easier context. But we are moving to timetable. We have had our new strategy and organogram accepted by the political principal. She mandated us to proceed with the match and place process and the populating of the new organogram, which is underway at the moment. But I'd add that we haven't been waiting for that in order actually to move into the new massified mode of operation. In other words, we're in some ways running our deliverables concurrently with the process of restructuring the organization to deliver them. And an example in point is the massified induction program, where the hope is to give some induction to the 100,000 people who join the civil service anew every year. So that has already been planned and is being rolled out as a deliverable of the new structure, even at the same time as we're bringing the new structure into place. Just the last point, Chair, that we are pleased we'll be moving into a new premises as we take on our new academy identity next door to the Department of Trade and Industry, which we hope is a good address. And as part of that, of course, there are challenges and risks to be identified and managed. For example, we're currently stabilizing our IT in the old environment so that we can move it across in a well-functioning fashion to the new arena. We're contemplating, for example, reviewing our risk register to take account of the new organogram and the new mode of functioning. And then our audit committee will monitor that with our colleagues from the AG.
Thank you, Mr. Orphan. That's to be all for the chair. Any other members need to ask questions, you can go ahead.
All right. Thank you very much. Do you want to say something, Sula?
Possibly just a comment on the board, Chair. The growth fund has actually seen continual improvement over the last 5-6 years. And I also believe that a lot of that success in moving the organization to a well-controlled and monitored organization has a lot to do with Professor D.P. van der Nest as chairperson of that committee. I do believe that seniors here and present with us today, that maybe with the Honourable Chair's permission, one could allow him maybe a few minutes just to summarise some of the possible lessons learnt that we and also the scope of the committee could possibly learn from the importance of Audit Committee's perspective. Just for some background, Dr. van der Nest did his doctorate in Audit Committees, which also included the public sector environment, and I think that's where the prominence was, if I recall. So I do believe he could add some value seeing his present stature. Thank you.
All right, a minute? Yeah. We sure would want to hear that.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Well, of course, it's not a one-man show, but audit committees should be developed as one of the key accountability instruments in government. I think that was the idea behind the Public Finance Management Act, as to constitute it with a majority of independent members. However, I think the success in SAMBI and comparing with other departments to the effectiveness of audit committees, first of all, would be the involvement and the attendance of the Director General in an audit committee and the relevant managers. I found where the accounting officer is not involved in them, that the effectiveness of the audit committee is less, or it is less effective in terms of its monitoring role. And I think also the structure of the agenda of the audit committee in terms of the key issues that should be addressed in terms of risk management, assurance on that risk management by internal audit, external audit, and also overseeing financial reporting is very important. And then keeping follow-up or track of improvements or proposed improvements by management and implementation plans, and also getting independent assurance on the effectiveness of those plans from the side of internal audit, I think is very important. That, of course, you must be a well-prepared committee with members preparing well and understanding the environment that they work in. I think, in short, that is what I would like to say, Chair. The involvement of senior management and the accounting officer, I think, is key. And that has been part of the success of the SAMBI. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I hope that with our engagement with you as SAMBI, it will help to brush up our image a little bit, that we're not a mean committee, that only calls people to knock them on their heads and say, no, kill. And indeed, somebody is a living testimony that we can get things right. We can make fundamental and drastic changes in the way public funds are managed and administered. And we are very happy and proud as a committee as well to be having you today in this position. And that's why we're a bit lenient to allow you to talk to us a little bit, because we think it is also good that those who do right should come and say, this is how we get it right. And hoping that from those such experiences, others could benefit, and ultimately we could change the picture for the better. And of course, the issues that the auditors have reported on, they relate to to monitoring and control, and these are management functions, supervision. You may have the processes, the procedures in place, but if they are not effectively monitored, you will always have cases of deviation or non-compliance. So I think in this dialectical process of tightening things up within somebody, we would say maybe that is the one area that you need to really focus on, so that all these deficiencies could be eliminated. But otherwise, we were quite impressed with the progress that the entity has made. In our last encounters, I think there were less miles around. But I think today we can afford to. Thank you very much. And we hope that it will not be one step forward, two steps back. And the next year we will come here with something worse than what we have. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair and colleagues. We fully intend not to see you next year. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Can we have the Department of Labor straight away? fact, let us continue and welcome the Department of Labor. It is not the first time that we're engaging. I think we have been engaging on a regular basis. However, I must also acknowledge, hoping that the auditors and my colleagues will agree with me, that there are issues that we have raised in the department that have been resolved, that there has been movement. But, of course, there are still issues that remain outstanding, as reflected in the report of the Auditor General. So I think it is these issues that we would want to talk about. And of course, it will not necessarily be our way of welcoming you, Acting DG, to your new position. But however, welcome you. Let me straight away hand over to Comrade Pierre to kickstart our process.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, maybe if I can just ask for Mr. Kehilda, is there any specific reason why this report hasn't been signed by the previous DG that has left the department? Chairperson, honourable member, I was under the impression that the report has been signed. Then I don't have any idea as to why it has not been signed.
Okay. Well, one will have to make their own interpretation of that. But be that as it may, welcome back, Chairperson. I think what we should, as so far, do, and not necessarily relating to this department as well, but to many of the departments and some of the entities, we have a situation where you have a DG that is departed, and then someone else has come in, like you yourself today, and take responsibility for what we worked with yesterday, which I think is very unfair, although you've been there the whole time. But I think we should really change this in that. If a DG has been involved in this post for that specific year, even though he has left, we should get him to come and, him or her to come and explain, or in conjunction with the one that is chairing or taking over. So be that as it may, in the previous hearing that we had, there was an issue raised, and I think it still hasn't been resolved. And this has nothing to do with the specific individual involved, but it's got to do with the size of your department and the amount of money that you are working with. And that is the fact that last year we pointed it out in our hearing that the CFO is at the level of chief director, where even many departments with the size of yours and even smaller, the CFO is normally at the level of DDG. And the previous DG said that that this issue, I'm quoting him here, he is currently at chief director level, and we are not satisfied with that. If you look at our department, which has staff that pays around 7,000 to 8,000 people, therefore means that we should have staff fit at a level which would make us attractive. We needed expertise.
this is a matter which is receiving our attention. We have not taken this matter up in a way that perhaps could change things. We will follow up on this. Now, I'd just like to know, has there been movement on this situation?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. I started acting from the 1st of December last year, and what I have done immediately is to begin to work on these audit issues. In fact, I've almost had a meeting every week with all people concerned dealing with all of the audit issues. One of those issues that I have asked for information to be made available is the level of CFO. I have asked our human resource management component to scan through the departments, other departments, to see at what level those are, what is the job description of the CFO at the Deputy Director General, if they are at that level in other departments, so that we can then make a recommendation to the minister on the level of the post. So we are working on that, and I hope that we can, within due course, get that information to enable us to make that decision.
Can we be
until the 1st of December, there has not been any movement on the issue.
Can we be appraised when there is
yes, I will,
when there is conclusion on the matter?
In our next report to the committee, includes progress on that matter.
All right.
I just wanted to come to the earlier question. The report that I have, the DG has signed the report, the 267 report, on page 70 of that report. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kendler. On page 2 of your report, on page 2 of the report, the annual report, the National Skills Development Strategy aim of the project and any achievements. And I just want to get some clarity on this. It says here on the first bullet, 26,000 levy paying SMMEs and 4,200 non-levying were supported. Then what worries me is the following bullet. It says here 57,000 workers entered learning programs and 21,000 completed. In other words, it's just a little bit more than a third. Then 46,000 entered ABET levels and 12,000 completed. That's about a quarter. 118,000 unemployed people were trained, 19,000 were placed. That's some better. And then the other one here is 41,000 unemployed learners entered learning programs and 12,000 completed, which is about a third or nearly a quarter. Are you satisfied with the levels, and why is there such a big dropout or failure rate when it comes to these numbers of pupils?
The explanation for the numbers completed vis-a-vis numbers entered is that they don't enter all at the same time. These are learnerships that commence at various times of the year. So if one cuts off at the end of the financial year, then you take those that have completed in that financial year. But the others may be in the system because it's 6 months or 12 months programs that they go into. So there is an overlap with the financial years. And that is the explanation for that.
But is it possible to separate these so that you are able to give a more accurate picture?
Yes, we can, in our next report, take into consideration the point raised so that we have a more accurate relationship between completed and entered.
Exactly, because otherwise the picture it creates is that either people drop out or whatever. So you could say so many entered and this was the completion date and these are the completion date, so many passed, so many dropouts, and these, the completion date is beyond the end of the financial year, then we're able to look at the figures much more accurately. All right.
Thank you. Then Mr. Kettledas, on page 65 of the annual report, at the bottom, governance committees. It says here there are numerous committees that have been put in place by the department to ensure so. Then the second last sentence says, however, the Auditor General is required by the Treasury regulations to appoint an audit committee as a subcommittee of the Auditor General. That is not correct. Am I right?
Yes, it has been drawn to our attention that it is not correct, and we'll issue an erratum to fix that.
Thank you. Then, regarding your vacancies, you have quite a high percentage of vacancies. Vacant positions. We struggle to about 131 million rand based on average salary. What are you doing to speed up the filling of these vacancies?
Chairperson, we, towards the end of last year, we have started an extensive verification exercise of our establishment. We have, for example, taken a print out of the person and got each manager to verify, first of all, those people that are in their employment, that are in their establishment. We have gone further to then look at the organizational structure to again verify that what they say is in a directorate, that we have those people in that directorate. We have so far then come with a process where we now have 792 posts that are shown to be vacant, with 67 posts that are frozen, and filled posts 6,462, and that gives you then a total of 7,321. Which includes the Unemployment Insurance Fund and the Compensation Fund. So if we are then look at that as a percentage of the overall establishment, it is then at about 10.8%. But we're not satisfied with that. The exercise that we then continue to do is then to determine that those vacant posts, whether we still require those or not, and whether we should abolish some of those posts. Because we have had the experience in the previous period that posts were created but not filled. So they are on your establishment but they are not filled. So we have to review the 792 vacancies now together with the frozen posts and then clean up there and then see whether which of those posts we still need to fill and which we don't need to fill. But we have gone through this exercise very extensively to try and determine the accurate status of the establishment, the accurate level of vacancy, so that we can then make decisions. And that process we hope we can conclude by the end of March this year. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, as you mentioned yourself, you said some of these posts, or most of them, I presume, get advertised internally. And then when you don't people that can fill those positions, then you don't advertise outside. Now, in terms of time frame, how long do you actually advertise a post internally before you go and source outside this one?
The posts that are advertised internally are those, I think, up to level 6. External advertising is more or less a month that the advert I mean, from the date of Edward to the closing date. Internally as well, yes.
Okay. So I know it's only a month that we are losing if we don't get someone from inside the organization. And then we go outside. That would be nice. Okay. Then, Mr. Kettledust, on your underspending, many departments have underspending of certain percentages, but you have one or two which is a bit high. Your underspending on program 4, your labor policy and labor market, the payment for capital assets, there's a 75% underspending, and the previous year you had zero underspending. And then on program 5, on your social insurance, your transfer and subsidies, you had a 26% underspending. Is there any specific reason for these two high figures?
I'm just trying to find out exactly where you are. Page 31. I'll just ask the CFO to deal with that. My understanding is that some of that is for capital work that are the responsibility of the public works.
That's correct. The capital works involve rent programs, repairs and maintenance projects. And we have a number of these rent projects that have expired and another contractor has not yet been approved.
I think the essence of this question is that in the previous financial year, other than the one under discussion, your payment for capital assets under expenditure was 0%, and then the following financial year, under expenditure shoots up to 75%. Why? What happened? Where and how was the bottleneck created to create such a huge under expenditure? I think it's trying to come.
The amount that we spend on capital assets or invoices that we get from public works, we do not, and we may not enter into capital transactions on our own. The payments that we make are governed by payments or invoices that we get from government.
Alright, so if you get no invoices, you keep the money. Oh, alright, okay, no, fine.
I just say that, incidentally, we are transferring payments to them in the last week based on the invoice that we received from them. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kedlodas, the RSC levy, your contributions towards the Legal Services Council, there was a cessation of these things. What does that mean? Does it mean that just explain to me how this works with cessation.
It came to a stop because we're not required to pay the RSC levies anymore. That's why it ceased.
And then all your RSC levies have been paid?
Yes. Yes.
Then, Mr. Kettledust, your internal audit establishment thereof consists of 29 posts, of which, for the purposes of this annual report we're working with, 17 were vacant, which is quite a lot. Could you just unpack that for us and give us a reason for this and if it has been corrected for us?
Yes, there has been a vacancy rate there, and hopefully within the process that we have embarked on to verify the establishment and to look at the vacant posts and where we would need to fill critical posts, we would be addressing that issue within that context.
So if I may ask, of the 29 posts, how many are now posts?
I do not have 14 are now posts.
So you've improved from 12 to 40. In a year's time. That's not an improvement.
The CFO just went to add to this.
Honorable Chairperson and Member, in this particular area, we have a big, big problem. I think it's much, much likely a controversial problem in government. In the sense that in many occasions, recently, we had, quite one example, we had an internal auditor starting on day one, and on that same day, resigned to leave the service by the end of that same month due to higher salaries that person was offered elsewhere. Some of these people stay no longer with X money. So that is a problem, and I think maybe we should look at the level that the other departments are paying, auditors at the level that we are paying here, and review that, and I think that might resolve the problem.
Thank you. I'd like to come to your leave situation. The comment is made that capturing an approval of leave, there's a significant uncertainty, this is from the Auditor General, in the control environment, commitment to competence and management style. Leave are not captured, all of it, under social systems. Administration of leave forms are sometimes not stamped, and some of them are filed incorrectly or captured incorrectly on the personal system. And then leave are not improved sometimes in time. Could you just tell us how you are rectifying these problems?
Okay, Preston, we have done extensive work on the leave situation, and the latest position is that they have brought that up to date for all of the officers, and we hope that, and we've also now made it a key performance area for managers by incorporating that responsibility into their performance agreements as well, so that we do hold people accountable for where they do not comply with it. So the information that we have is that from all of our officers, the leave has been followed up, it's been captured right up to December, before the shutdown in December, or when people went on leave in December.
Shouldn't speak about shutdown.
Yeah.
You really think
yeah. Yeah.
Chair, but
I worked in a factory, yeah. Chair, so I'm used to, to shut down.
No shading. No, the issue about leaves is, I think, has been deteriorating, because in 2005 it wasn't mentioned by the AG, and 2006 it wasn't mentioned by him, and in 2007 it's actually emphasized. So I really think we should improve this, but I would just like to know, one of the comments from the Auditor General said that leaves are not approved in time. Now, if someone's leave is not approved in time, and he goes on leave, what do you do about it? Is he breaking the rules of the department, or is it, do they just accept it? Fine, because they are in fact problems and they take their leave anyway.
No, it's unacceptable that leave is not authorized before people go. I mean, it becomes unauthorized leave if you go without kind of authorization having been given. And that is what we are monitoring very closely now, and making the responsibility of the managers that no leave should be proceeded with unless it has been authorized.
And then what do you do with people who do not authorize leave in time, on time?
We'll have to charge them with misconduct.
Has that happened? I'm taking it out to a practical level beyond the conceptual.
Well,
because, I mean, it's from what the comrade is asking, that's what the auditors have identified as an area of challenge. Somebody applies for leave, it's supposed to be processed within a particular time frame, it is not done in time, and yet the person who is so applied cannot leave unless and until it is approved. But somebody is sitting with the leave application form and processing them.
Okay.
Well, as I say, we have now made it as part of the manager's core management criteria that these things must be done timeously, correctly, and in full compliance. What we will also do very soon is to have a meeting with all our managers, as the Honourable Member indicated. We have 129 labour centres around the country, and we are going to meet with the heads of those labour centres to discuss issues like this, because we believe that it is the responsibility of all managers to fully comply with all of the issues that the auditors, for example, have raised. If there's a problem of leave, it is at the lowest level of manager that you have to address this. And that is why we're going to meet with them to emphasize their responsibility in this regard, as well as other matters that have come up in the auditing process.
Just on your answer there, you said that you've got 129 labor centers, but in the minutes of the previous hearing, the previous DG said, I recall, it's 123. Is it close or 129?
I think what may have happened is that sometimes satellite offices are counted in, which then gives you a different figure. But if you talk offices, labor centers, satellite offices where officials of the department go out to a particular point, but they're not there permanently. They go on a intermittent basis. For example, Human Source, where I come from, they would go on Tuesdays and Thursdays only. Now, there's no office, but it's taken as a satellite office. Sometimes people count that in under labor centers.
Thank you. Then regarding your fixed assets, which was also highlighted by the Auditor General, it says here your fixed assets as disclosed in Note 30 to the financial statements were not adequately supported by an asset register as described by National Treasury by the time of the audit. The accuracy and completeness of the fixed asset register and the closing balance of assets reflected 123 million, and this could not be verified. Could you give us a comment if this has been improved?
Yes, thank you, Jefferson. We have since then embarked on a process to verify all assets. We have put in place what we refer to as an interim asset management team consisting of a number of officials drawn from the provinces to go around to all of the offices to verify the assets. They have completed most of the offices by now. The project is to correct the AMS asset register, which includes a stock take countrywide, as well as the reconciliation between BAP and LOGIS. And after the completion of this phase of going around the country, checking the offices, making sure that barcodes are there, that we know the location of the assets, that the balances then on the AMS register, the parts in the local systems, will then be reconciled. And our target date to complete this is the end of April. So a lot of work is being done on this checklist.
Thank you. One of the comments of the AG also says that the department does not have a dedicated asset management unit. You just mentioned that you are using internal staff now. And also, he goes on to say that the asset verification process was outsourced due to a lack of skills and capacity in the department. Now, this outsourcing apparently was problematic because the commencement by the service provider was delayed, and inadequate monitoring of the service provider also resulted in challenges not timely detected. Now, what were these challenges which were not timely detected? What were they? And why was this appointment of the or the commencement of the asset verification by the service provider? Why was it delayed? And this whole process, what changed the mind of the department to now have its own internal asset verification unit, or is it done in conjunction with a service provider as well?
The service provider is no longer there. The internal team that we used was to do the stock take to verify around the country. There is no dedicated asset management unit in place at the moment. In the MTF allocations for 2008 and 2009, we have now funding available for the establishment of a directorate for risk and asset management. So by the 1st of April, we would want to have this unit established, or that capacity established within the department. The I have no direct information with regard to the delay in the appointment of the of the service provider. Maybe the chief financial officer has information with regard to that. I don't have that information. Thank you.
I cannot judge for what the delay was, but the bid that we had for employing a consultant to assist with the asset was adjudicated by the departmental standing bid committee in July or August of 2006, and the approval was only granted by the then acting Director General, Mr. Monkontu, on the 21st of December. Now, had that approval been granted earlier, the consultants would most likely have been able to complete the job.
Just a minute. Will please have our cellular phone off? Because every time it rings, it affects the recording of the discussion. So, please just have them off.
The honourable member, I cannot doubt why there was that delay.
Thank you. The Auditor General also said here that there were four versions of the asset register submitted for audit.
How many are there now?
But Chairperson, we should only have one. I cannot explain why four versions were submitted, and we will ensure that only one version is submitted. We definitely cannot.
Thank you, Mr. Chibuda. Then I'd like to touch on an outstanding debt. There are staff debtors amounting to 10.2 million rand that is older than 3 years that hasn't been written off. Now this opens up the whole thing for either rushing to go and write it off to get it off the books, and in the process, the possibility of not doing enough to get the debt paid. Could you give us progress on this? What is the current situation with these outstanding debts older than 3 years?
Thank you. The finance section would treat each case on its merits. And with the advice from legal services, the irrecoverable debt is then written off. And this is an ongoing process. But so far, on the advice of our legal services in the department, 1.1 million has been written off for the 7 and 8 financial year. But for the rest, we are pursuing the recovery of these debts. But we have to do it through the state attorney's office. For them then to pursue the matter or to say or to advise us, no, it is not recoverable, it should be written off. But the optimal is, of course, to recover the debt. And efforts are being made with that. We have asked our legal service people to follow up with the State Attorney's Office on progress on that side with regard to matters that have been referred to them to recover. Or to advise us that they are unable to recover.
Thank you. Thank you. On page 101 of the annual report, also relating to outstanding debt, item 7 there, you say that you, 7.1, debt written off, 863,000 rand were written off of these staff debts. Now, what do you actually do to go and recover the debt? If someone owes the department money, I mean, is a letter sent, or is it deducted from the salary, or is it staff that used to work for the department that are no longer in service? If you can maybe just give us a bit of clarity so we understand it better.
Where they are, well, those that are in the department, you have to deduct it from their salary. Those that are leaving, like somebody going on pension, or somebody dismissed or resigned, you recover outstanding monies from those monies due to them. For those that have, where you only pick it up after they have left, that is where you then have to write a letter to the person, you have to, if you get no response, you then refer it to the state attorney for them to then follow that up. But as much as we can, those that are in the process of leaving, you recover either from salaries due or from the even from the pension funds that are available, are accruing to them, that you then recover the money from that.
Okay, so the amount of 10.2 million which is outstanding for 3 years according to the 2007 report, which you're working on, and you say another 1.1 has been written off, which leads it to about 9 million. So there's actually a possibility that that the 9 million could have subtracted, am I right?
Well, I'm not sure, not all of it, but there may be others. We'll follow that up with the state attorney's office to see what is prescribed and what is not. But these are sometimes small amounts, like 100 rand, 200 rand, but one has to follow the process forward. I have asked that we get more details with regards to this, so that we know exactly what is the people that are leaving, what is for people that have left. It may also be that some of these people deceased or is no longer around. But we need more accurate information with regards to this. It's too broad for me at the moment to be clear as to what possibilities we have of recovering the outstanding debt.
Before you continue, and maybe the auditors could come in. I'm just struggling to come to terms with a situation where you would have an employee who has a debt, and for the next 3 or 4 months or whatever, he ends or she ends the salary every month, and yet the debt remains there. It is there, standing. I think it's done to it. Or if there have been arrangements to get the money from that person, the person leaves the department while there is still some outstanding money, even gets his or her pension, and yet the debt remains in the department. I don't understand where the challenge lies and how it comes about.
Mr. Chair, it's twofold. It's firstly a lack of proper internal control, and then secondly a lack of supervision monitoring, because that way that outstanding debt should have been detected and followed up on a monthly basis. That's basically the two root causes for this finding.
Sounded as simple as all that to me as well. So I mean, we shouldn't be coming across as a very complicated matter. And for me, it's something that should not even happen. But either a person owes the department, and the salary section is completely ignorant of that or is not aware. The person leaves the department, the pension is processed, and the person gets his or her money, and in another department, compartment completely sealed off from the other, there is an amount sitting there as debt. So I think we need to have a way in which these things are reconciled, so that the person owes the department today. I mean, somewhere in the system, it is known, and there are ways in which the money is recovered. Otherwise, wouldn't then have debts that are not recoverable and to be written off because the people have left the employ of the department. That's my understanding. Unless if I'm missing something in terms of how things are running.
Yes, that's correct. This is an area that needs tightening up, because you can't have a situation where somebody has left. I think it's the synchronization of the information that causes this problem. That a person leaves, finance doesn't know about until the person is left, and then pick up that there's an outstanding debt. We've got to tighten up on that synchronization of the information so that we don't have this gap occurring. It's the lagging of information getting through to the section, because it's the HR section is the finance section. I think we need to tighten up on that control there.
Yeah. And I think it's not only in your department, but I think generally we do come across that aspect. And I think our line has generally been, these debts are old, why are they not written off? Without dealing with the actual, so how do you ever come to have debt by employees who have left the department? There's no way in which you can trace either those employees, or there's no way in which the department can recover the debt that these people have created. So I think you're correct, the synchronization, that is what is very important. Yes, Kobaski.
Thank you, Chair. According to the Auditor General, there has also been an underutilization of 72% of subsidized vehicles. Now, could you just explain to us these subsidized vehicles? How does the system work? Are the members of or the employees buying the vehicles on a subsidized tariff, but do they also have to use these vehicles for departmental work? Can you explain to us how this works?
Yes, Chairperson, there are employees like inspectors whose inherent job function includes having to drive to go and inspect workplaces. The formula at the moment is that they should spend 70% of their kilometer or use of the vehicle on business and 30% on private. Now, we have a situation where we have 430 subsidized vehicles. We have withdrawn six of those because they're not meeting the criteria. Now we find that in some cases the utilization rate is 69.1%. Then that would be deemed not to be meeting the 70%. So you have quite a number of vehicles that are close to the 70%. But they're not 70%. They're 69.1, some 69.8. I have an example. 69.5, 66%, 67%. There are vehicles like that. Now, we have been advised that because this is a National Department of Transport policy,
that they are also in the process of reviewing the policy to make it more flexible. Because at the moment it's just a 70-30. They're now looking at options, for example, of 60-40. That will then overcome your problem with these people that are utilizing the vehicle in excess of 60%, but not 70%. And you also have an 80-20% option. So they're looking at possibly having the three options, the 60-40, 70-30, and the 80-20, which then would give you flexibility in the utilization of those vehicles, so that when those that fall within those ranges, 60-40, they will be subsidized to that extent. Those in the 70-30 range would be subsidized to that extent, and those in the 80-20 range would be subsidized to that extent. And that, we believe, may help us in resolving this issue. Inspectors do use these vehicles to go and visit workplaces. And we have, in fact, seen an improvement in the utilization of that of those vehicles, where they have, for example, up to now, inspected 95,000 workplaces compared to 180,000 in the previous period for a full year. So there is an improvement in the utilization rate. But as I say, you know, if you use the vehicle 69.1%, you're not compliant. And that is a difficult issue to have. We think that this flexibility in having these three options may assist us to a large extent to deal with this problem. Okay, thank you. Just one or two short questions in the annual report. I'd like to give my colleague, Mr. Madhiza, a chance. On page 94, if you take chronologically, on page 94, in terms of assets, prepayments and advances. In 2005 and 6, you had 45 million prepayments and advances there. And in 2006 and 7, you only have 8.1 million. What was the reason for that decrease?
Just ask the CFO to deal with that.
Honourable Member, that receivables reflected there for prepayments and advances. In the previous year, you'll see it's 45.9 million, it dropped to 8 million. These are monies that we recover from the Unemployment Insurance Fund and from the Compensation Fund. Remember, the three funds in the department run through the TARSOL program 33, all three. Employees of all three of those institutions. And through that, it comes onto the Department of Labor, and we then have to recover from the compensation fund and from UIF. Now, in the previous year, they were like 3 months in arrear in refunding the department, whereas this particular year, they were more up to date in actually re-advancing the department on what we had expended.
I'm covered, thank you, Chair. Then my second last question, on page 108, item 25.2, irregular expenditure, it's an old item that comes from 205 and 6, of an amount of 927,000 rand. It's an amount not approved by sub-tender committee. There's the investigation in process. And then just below that, expenditure in conservation of tender board regulations, investigation in process. Those two items there, could you just give us a progress report on what that was and how far in the investigation?
I just asked the CFO to deal with it. I'm not aware of this one, Chief.
Chairperson, the 927,000 that is for both years, that was a mistake of a skills conference. I cannot remember off the cuff what the expenditure and contravention and the tender board regulations are. And overtime not approved timely, I think that's the item that was also covered in terms of the leave that the Auditor General referred to, where overtime was worked, that the overtime had not been approved timely.
Could you maybe supply that in writing, especially with the one which is an old item, the 927,000, how far that is?
Right.
Okay, then my last question, if I may.
Well, last question. On that same item, the last one, overtime not approved timely. Just link it back with leave not approved timely. See, these delays, it's not good. And it relates to management function. And when you take it further up, it will then require that at a supervision level, it has to be strengthened to ensure that managers do their work appropriately and most importantly, timely. Yeah, just wanted to link this one with the previous one that we spoke about, the committee.
Thank you, Chair. Then on page 119, just for clarity, the annexure 1B, statement of transfers to non-profit institutions. The last item there on the transfer, most of these items, you know, if there's an amount, adjusted appropriation amount that's allocated, and then the actual transfer is normally exactly the same amount or less. But here we have an amount of 36 million, which was allocated for subsidized work centers for people with disabilities. And the amount that was actually transferred was 45 million, which is 23% more than what was allocated. In terms of how your department finances work, this excess amount from which other program is that amount being taken?
Yeah, honourable member, the towards the end of the financial year, the subsidised work centres for people with disability ran into a financial crisis, and we had to bail them out; otherwise, they would not be able to pay their creditors. So we applied a variance, which the DG had approved. So we moved funds, I can't remember exactly from which program, but we moved funds and the DG approved those funds we moved. So we did not exceed our budget, but we did exceed what the estimate or the adjusted appropriation for this particular item.
Do you recall what the cost of that difficulty was? That required a bailout of almost 10 million.
Honourable Chairperson, the arrangement with self-employment is that we subsidise the operational losses and we subsidize the capital equipment. Now, I think as when we come to the sheltered employment, which I see is further down on the program, I think there'll be more insight into this, because since the preferential procurement status of sheltered employment has been removed, the sales are going one way, and that's downwards, which means that the subsidy, in order to keep this 1,100 people, disabled people, employed, we have to increase the subsidy year after year after year after year, and I think Treasury can attest to that, this is getting problematic unless we can turn around the shock of employment by getting some sort of protection from the state to make it again a preferential provider to the state of some sort.
Okay, all right. Okay, now that's fine. Honorable Stevens and Honorable Kent, before we move to Walmart TV's.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to get back to the staff debt again, because I'm a bit concerned about the collection practice of 3 years and how you go about it. The state must be a fair employer and adopt fair practices. I think we all agree on that. And I think we're all quite clear that it must never be allowed to get to a 3 year debt. I mean, it must be collected long before then. Or at north, if you can't collect. But those that are now over 3 years, I would like you to comment on your procedures that you follow to collect that, because there is such a thing as predatory debt collection, which I think we should be, the state should definitely not indulge in. The Prescription Act says that any debt which is older than 3 years, from 3 years onwards, is not recoverable legally. But the debt is not extinguished. In other words, if somebody pays you, it's quite a legal payment and you can keep it. But you cannot institute legal action. Now, it's quite clear to me that the state certainly cannot act as some creditors do in the market, most I think. If you ask somebody to pay a debt that has described in the form that it is described, but that he nevertheless owes the money, and you ask him, but you can't threaten him, I don't think you... Well, now, I suggest to you that you cannot collect monies older than 3 years without disclosing to the person that you are asking, who is an employee who probably doesn't know the Prescription Act, who doesn't know his rights. You have to disclose to him that the debt is prescribed, but that it is not extinguished, that he in fact owes the money. Could you comment on that, please?
I can't disagree with that, Chief. I think that is why we do this through the State Attorney's Office, so that we do. but that is the directive that we have, that we must refer this to the State Attorney's Office. But you do find that when you try to locate the person at his or her last known address, you don't find the person. And we then refer it to the state attorney, and of course they must do the recovery in full compliance with the law. So I cannot disagree with you that we can't operate it if we are a rogue organization. So, Jefferson, as I indicated earlier, we will get a detailed breakdown of this, decide to see where this is in terms of the recovery process, whether it's all people that have left, maybe some of them have died, whatever, but we must clear this.
I think the critical area at MTG is the synchronization that is very important, so that we do not have these matters, and we do not have to have any case referred to the state attorney. I believe that it can be done within departments in a way that would prevent that. And I think we need to start to be a little tougher in terms of what we expect. People at management level, at supervisor level, to do. That for me, I believe, can solve our problem. Supervision, monitoring, accountability, these are the most important things that I think can solve this one for us. Honorable Chair?
Maybe we could just get a comment on that.
Well, must the comment start from the AG's office?
Yeah, I want to make sure that I'm correct in what I'm saying, because otherwise it's not fair for the department to respond to something which is not correct.
All right. Okay, my fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do an assessment of the transversal system, but the purpose of that assessment is to determine our auditory line, whether we do control testing or substantive testing. So just determine the extent of testing. It's not a reason for a qualification. If in the department there should be enough compensating controls to make sure that there's compliance with what the department has to perform.
No.
It contributed because there was inadequate compensating control.
All right. Yeah. Can we get a comment from the department?
That last sentence, the Auditor General's office felt should not be there. And we will correct that in the errata that we will issue. The last sentence there, the qualification reported by the Auditor General was a direct result of these deficiencies. So they have requested that we remove that. It's not a correct statement.
Thank you, Chair. Now, I just have one for the sake of accuracy. I think you should put my thing. I think there are misunderstandings for someone understands it.
Yeah, I think that going forward, it will be important that things that appear in the annual report, once it gets out, there has to be a way in which we must have gone through them and be satisfied that every sentence that is in here is supposed to be here. You recall in the other page, it was about the Auditor General as well, which you correctly said should not have been there. So, and again, we have this one. So I'm saying that I think there is need to tighten how we go through this information, process this information before it goes out, so that we, otherwise somebody who sees this report and who is not here will not have the benefit of the retraction, would have that impression. So documents that come to Parliament, documents that are for public consumption, I think we need to tighten that in that aspect. Yes, Honourable Chair?
Chair, I would just like to raise the issue of performance information, because it's something which is fairly new, I think it's somewhere we've got to get to. I don't want to quote this document from Fiji, because this is the framework which is set out by Fiji, and you must report and set your targets in terms of that framework. The AG has audited the information, that is what is said in your report, but we don't get any further than that, because I don't think we've got to that stage yet. But what I've been doing with departments over the past few months is just having a look at the way your performance indicators are set out, and whether, and then I ask myself the question, is this measurable or isn't it? Because if you read this book, I mean, the measurement of performance fundamentally important. It has a whole lot of spin-offs, and I don't want to go through the document what it says. And I just find, first of all, I want to say that a lot of your stuff is measurable, and I'm very happy about that. Definitely measurable, in terms of percentages and numbers. But there are still grey areas where a lot of the stuff is really very sort of airy-fairy, you know, sort of, it doesn't really get to the point of, this is the target, this is what we achieve. Now, nothing wrong with if you don't achieve your target, because at least you're being honest, you're telling us that you didn't achieve it. I think we're going to get to a point here where we will have to start interrogating why perhaps targets weren't achieved. So my first question is, it's just a very innocuous question. I do trust that you have taken note of this document and that you are striving to get the way you report as accurate and measurable as possible. And yeah, I'm happy that the DG has nodded his head, and we'll see what happens in 2019. You're new in the job, but anyway. But then, this is an example too. Now, can I just quote one example of what I'm talking about? And that is to be found on page 29 under your program 2, where your target was 75% compensation fund claims would be processed within 90 days from achieving the documents, and your actual that you achieved was 35%, which is considerably lower than your target. What would be the reason for that? Not being achieved, that target not being achieved.
The chairperson, the difficulty that we have with compensation claims, for example, is that the claim cannot be deemed to be complete if you haven't received all the forms. A compensation claim constitutes quite a number of forms. Firstly, the accident report form. Now, if there's been an accident, there's an injury. If the injury must then be treated, you need a medical report and possibly follow-up medical report. Now, you do find that we receive a claim which hasn't got all of that information. It may be reported. You may have an accident report form, but you don't have a medical report form, because the compensation is based on the pathetic disablement or injury that you have sustained.
But you see,
that is why the
pathetic
completeness is less.
No, my understanding of his question, if it isn't, I'll ask it. Your target was that the processing and paying of forms that have complete documentation. That is, these forms have all the documentation that you need. So you are excluding those that have come without, you know, your complete documentation. You're saying within 90 days, at least 75% of those must have been processed. Now, the actual says only 35% were processed within that period for those that were received with all the documentation. So I think he's narrowing it down to those that they had all the documents that you needed, excluding those that had outstanding documents.
Yes.
That the percentage achieved is quite low indeed, if it is for claims that had all the documentation.
Yes, that is something that we have to look at, because it shows that there's a lag in the system then, that they have not been able to complete or process and pay all of those that they have received. But the target is set for that. But I say sometimes, even if it's complete, you have to go back for additional information, which may cause delays. But we have to establish precisely what the lag in the system was that only enabled us to process the 35%. I can't explain now. I don't have the details of that.
Yes, that is the reason I actually asked the question, just to demonstrate something, which really, I'm not trying to be, you know, difficult in, but what I'm saying is, because you see, what this document says is, you cannot recognize failure, you cannot correct it. Now, what this is saying is that the reason he's doing this is that you should be looking at your targets and saying, well, now why didn't we achieve that, and then come up with a solution, because I think that's the purpose of this whole exercise. I just used the one, just as an example. Not meant as a criticism, but this report is almost going on for 8 or 9 months old now. Okay, you've had a long time to go through these. So maybe the next question is, do you go regularly, or do you go through your targets and see whether you've achieved them, and then try to find the reasons for not achieving, for non-performance? Do you do that? Is that a specific exercise which gets done every year, formally and properly?
That is expected, and we do that because when you prepare your next work plan, you must then take account of those issues that you've not achieved in the previous work plan, look at what the problems were, and then put in place mechanisms and processes to correct that within your next work plan. So that is done.
And you satisfy that that's working?
Yeah, I'm saying I wanted to cut it down, so we should. Okay.
Well, we need to improve that. As you said, we are monitoring performance on a quarterly basis, so we should be able to, even at a quarterly basis, begin to pick this up and in the next quarter to implement corrective action.
Okay. No, that's fine.
All right. Thank you very much. I think on that one, well, I don't see the chair. I see Comrade Mkomi here. I hope you've noted that one down. Because acting DG, people who are applying for compensation, they are people who are in need, vulnerable people. And if we are underperforming in assisting these people who might be in dire need of that compensation, we are failing at the critical point. So it might be an area that you certainly may need to focus on. I'm aware, and hopefully I'm correct, that those areas around compensation have been a challenge in terms of their efficiency and effectiveness. And I'm saying that saving people who are in vulnerable positions, certainly, those are areas where we need the utmost dedication from staff. And it might also relate to questions of supervision, again, monitoring. To what extent are our managers managing? To what extent are our supervisors supervising to ensure that they... And I would imagine you could find out what 35% the person supervising, at what point did he or she realize that would not meet the target, and what is it that was done to try and put an extra effort to meet the target, and after failing ultimately to meet the target, what measures are in place now to ensure that there is improvement. I mean, those are very simple and obvious things for anybody who is paid every month to manage or to supervise. And if those things are not done, our own people to whom a disservice is done. So I hope that you know it's actually the portfolio committee here.
Yeah, those are matters that will be put forward. But anyway,
yes, Mama TV.
The thank you, sir. I will just really be dealing with the national skills one. The AG has noted that the management did not implement a comprehensive process over the awarding of the contract for the social development initiative project at provincial level in order to comply with the requirements of the supply chain management as prescribed by Treasury Regulation Number 16.8.6.1 and 2. Now, my question is, how can this committee be assured that the contracts so awarded were free from, say, fraud, bribery, and corruption if there were no competitive bidding processes, bid specifications, bid evaluations, and bid adjudication committees for projects across the province in order that the supply chain management prescripts are satisfied or complied with. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honourable Member, we do have a procedure that is followed with regard to the allocation of funds for these projects at provincial level. Maybe I should just explain that a little bit, what that procedure is.
But I think acting DG, you see, the question of the presence of procedure and processes, policies, their documentation, I think there is recognition that you have those. But the question is, they are not complied with. I think that is the numb of the issue, that they are not complied with. And this question is, how can we, is it possible for us to be assured that in the process of non-compliance, there was no fraud, there was, I don't know, corruption, a form of bribery and all that kind of stuff. Your police are there and they have not been complied with. That's the essence of the question.
The Chief Director for the National Skills Fund will just explain how they deal with that.
No, it's fine. Maybe let him explain.
Thank you, Chair. I think, Chair, it's important, I mean, to be able to respond to the question. I think one needs to indicate that in our deliberations with the Auditor General's office, The issue, in my understanding of the basis of the qualification, is about saying that you're using a process that is different to what is perceived as should be the process in terms of, for example, the finding would say that there's no a clear but specification committee. Now, I think in terms of giving comfort, and I think that's my viewpoint that I expressed to the Auditor General, is that the issue of fraud and of bribery is not something that happens only when there is not compliance. In other words, what I'm saying is I'm trying to separate the issue about saying that we haven't fully aligned our procurement process to what Treasury Regulation 16A is saying. But, Chair, I think it's important to note for the committee that, for example, on the issue of competitive bidding and procurement, that one of the issues that we have tried to explain is that under the social development funding window, which is one part of the NSF in terms of our funding window, that there is no price competitive bidding because we got a set fixed price for every course that is funded under that particular funding window. So there is no difference between any provider, whether they provide an IT course that's on our database in Lusaki City or whether it's in Mpumalanga, you can only get 200 rand, for example, per contract. So in that regard, there is no disadvantage to the state, for example, to say that you could have done this thing at 20 rand instead of 50 rand.
So
the other issue then...
No, maybe just to do this. So in short, what you're saying is that the concerns raised by the auditors are not legitimate.
No, Chair, I should maybe have started. I mean, we have, and I mean, Ajit is here and Alex is here. We have indicated to them we are not fully agreeing with the nature of the finding. But the audit committee of the department, and we agree with that approach, have said to us, until such time that you find agreement, you address the concerns of the Auditor General. And we have started to do that. But I just thought, Chair, it's important to give the committee a sense that even under that process, we have a database where we register all the training providers. And in the appointment of any training provider, at least three quotations is seeked. And that's why I thought it's important to explain that there is the issue of formalization. So there's not a committee called a bid specification committee, but we have a process in which there is a clear-cut identification of what is the kind of project we're gonna fund and what is the criteria for that.
Yeah.
But to come back to the point, Shane.
No. I hear you, and I suppose that's the explanation you gave to the Auditor General's office.
Yes.
And it does not appear like they were convinced by that explanation. Otherwise, they would not have written this.
Yeah.
Because the actually, in relation to your social development funding window, they are saying that there was no invitation to tender to suppliers for projects that exceeded the threshold value. So it's either that statement is incorrect because there is no threshold window. Any funding in that window, you have a fixed, you know, you have a fixed price. And that the whole question of specification committee, bid evaluation committee, bid adjudication committee are completely unnecessary, because what Matiki is raising issues that the auditors have raised. So we are not here to adjudicate whether your argument or the AG's argument is right. Our assumption, our starting point, is that the issues that the Auditor General reports on and raise queries, does so because they legitimately and correctly so believe that they are wrong and they need to be corrected. You want to?
If you then feel strongly that you do not need to strictly adhere to treasury regulations, as is required by other departments, as is expected by the AG's office. Now, have you then applied to treasury for the exemption and exclusion of your fund from this regulation? Have you done that? Thank you.
Yeah. Chair, let me then say that. Chair, that despite what I've been saying, is that what we've been doing since the report has been finalized, we have started to align, to develop and look where is the areas where we need to tighten up to be able to comply with the Treasury regulation. We have also engaged with Treasury. We have been advised that, in fact, that if the department, for example, feel that there is special circumstances in terms of the nature of the business, that we cannot fully align to that, that the accounting officer of the department can actually approve that and then motivate why that needs to be done. But say what we are now, the approach that we are following now is to, for example, in the case where the AGF said that you haven't advertised, although you have a database. We have consulted with our supply chain management and they are fully engaged with us, for example, on the concept of a body shop approach, where we can immediately put all those training providers on our database in a body shop. The provinces will then be expected to only draw from that particular body shop. So we have developed actually the whole alignment document.
Okay.
To be able to comply with this and to address this qualification.
Okay. Is there anything that Treasurer would want to say around this matter?
Thank you, Chairperson. No, Mr. Lepre is actually right. The exemption is allocated to the DG. He has the power to, in terms of Treasury Regulation 16A64, to deviate from the competitive bid process. And
advise
them accordingly.
I see. It's an instrument that has been available all along. And I would imagine that every accounting officer should be aware of its existence, so that we wouldn't then be having these arguments and debates over whether this is how you do it, this is how you don't do it. It's as simple as all that. Don't think that it was even necessary for the auditors to have even had this finding. All that was required was for the accounting officer to have applied to National Treasury. That's the simplest thing. other than an explanation that at the end of the day did not convince the auditor. So I'm saying therefore that these are some of the things that are so obvious and so simple. But yes, acting digital.
No, Chairperson, I was just going to say that now that I have that responsibility, I will give this matter immediate attention.
Thank you very much. Bama to you.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Let's step off this platform now. Let's talk to commitments. The observation is that the commitments were not accurately and complete. In that assurance relating to the accuracy and completeness of commitments amounting to 745 million, as per note 17 to the annual financial statement, could not be obtained. Now, why could assurance relating to the accuracy and completeness of commitments not be obtained by the AG?
Chairperson, I think this arose from the accounting system that has been utilized at the time, and we are developing an accrual-based accounting system, which we understand will ensure that the commitments are then correctly reflected on the financial statement.
Was it that all along you had an exemption not to use the accrual system? Or why is it only now that you are developing that capacity of switching to an accrual based system?
Yeah, actually the first time that it was the issue of that accrual accounting was raised, I think, in the 2005-06 financial year. And then subsequently, because the view of the accountant general was, despite the fact that the NSF is operating as a program, as well as the AG, the opinion was expressed that it should actually be a public entity. So the accountant general then gave us exemption for the last 2 years in that regard. But still, we expected, although we're using a cash-based, modified cash basis, that we then should disclose the commitments. In fact, what the exercise then now, as the acting DG said, is to then now, whilst we are busy with the other issue about the legal status of the NSF, in the meantime we need to comply, and hence then the decision to develop a accrual accounting for the NSF to be able to comply with that particular problem that we have been experiencing.
All right. So it does appear that your legal status has been lingering for quite some time. Are we anywhere closer to resolution?
Yes, Chairperson, to give effect to that, we need to effect an amendment to the skills development legislation. We have a draft bill that has been prepared, and hopefully soon we'll be able to take this through the processes to have that amendment effected to the skills development act.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. The AG has observed that the root cause of the incompleteness of the statements towards committed funds is due to inadequate filing and administration, absence of the required systems to support this process, and the lack of monitoring. The information for the accurate disclosure of the funds so committed. Then your comment, on what basis can you refute that?
No, I think, Chair, the previous response obviously indicated that the department don't dispute the fact that the absence of accrual accounting appropriate system was a big contributing factor to that, because what it means that, in a sense, you actually have to manually keep records of those accruals. And in addition to that, we also there was also a little bit of confusion about what qualifies to be a commitment and so forth. And hopefully this year we will have in writing that common agreement. Because one of the issues, for example, where the differences also came from is, for example, initially, which we believe is legitimate, is to include those commitments where you have signed the contract, you have approved the project by in the process of finalizing of the contract. Now, the AG's view was you must exclude that. And so part of the revision was around issues like that. But the main issue is, honorable member, it is about the fact that we had to operate in a body in that is not suited for what we are required to do in terms of what we are perceived from a legal point of view. And that has been a major contributing factor. But in the meantime, while developing the system, we have put mechanisms in place to be able to, even manually, to be able to keep record of those. So when it comes to end of the year, it will be easier then to be able to have a more proper reflection of commitments.
Yeah, I think that the question of the inadequate solar system certainly do create these possibilities, you know, of failure. But we must not put them at the center. I think the human factor must always be at the center. That is what we from this side, in terms of revolutionary politics, understand. And I think it applies to everything. The question of keeping a file, it's all about an employee. If something is purchased or you receive a receipt, where do you put it? That has nothing to do with whether you are accounting on a cash base or modified cash base or accrual system. The question of file administration, inadequate file administration, it has to do with the human factor, lack of monitoring of process. It has to do with supervision, with management, with human beings. So I'm saying that you may go to accrual, but if your employees do not do their work as expected, you still have all this sort of thing. So I'm trying to say that let's not move away from the human factor. It must be at the center of it all. Whatever else must be impacted upon by the human factor. Yes, over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Well articulated. Now, would you assure this committee that this issue of filing an administration and misunderstanding about commitment will be a fact of history come the next financial annual report? Thank you.
Yes, Chairperson, we have to do that. Otherwise, you have to come and see your game.
We all wish it to be like that, but it must be like that. Way, way beyond how we wish it to be. I felt this question was more like a square pass in Soccer Palace. What else would you say? Can you assure us? Surely you'll give us that assurance. But anyway, we take the assurance in good faith that we're all committed to seeing to it that there is improvement.
Let's now actually talk to the material corrections to financial statements. There have been a series of material corrections made to the financial statements submitted for audit. Observation by the AG seems to suggest that the root cause to this is the shortage of skilled officials with the requisite accounting knowledge. Your comments on this observation. Thank you. Would you agree or disagree with them?
No, Chair, through you, we must agree with the misstatements, and I mean some of the causes of that, and one of the major sources of that was the issue around the commitments, the differences in the commitment figures. But obviously, we agree that there was that there was amounts initially in the build up to finalization of the of the financial statements that had to be changed.
I think I did get from the auditors that it is not necessarily a big crime or a crime to revise figures in the process of auditing. and indeed it might not be, but for me it does not give a positive picture. I don't know, having been a teacher, you know, when you're doing a schedule with all sorts of marks going this way and calculating that way, sort of writing 5, you may write 6. I know it does happen, and at the end your thing will not, you know. But it's not something that, you know, when you take for submission, say this is what we're submitting, these are official submissions, and you find that, you know, you have to revise the figures so drastically, it might be a point that there is no sustained attention and focus to, you know, to the things that we write. And I might be wrong, and I hope and wish I'm wrong. But I'm just saying that there has to be a sense in which when our work is done, one gets a sense that indeed there is complete dedication to. Well, my understanding is that the National Treasury and even the AG's office, they are there throughout the year for the departments in case there are issues of misunderstanding. So those things don't have to come up during the audit process. But like I say, maybe I misunderstand these things, and I hope I do, because if I don't, then it still goes back to the question of the attitude with which people approach their work. You want to make an addition, Matthias? Anyway, it's your time.
Yes, thank you, Chair. But then I think the core of the question is the observation that the people so employed in those positions, it is the feeling of the Auditor General that they are not qualified. They do not possess the requisite skills. For the fact that the corrections were material, it's not an accidental mistake of writing 4 instead of 5. So, do they agree with that statement or not? That's the core question. Thank you.
Honourable Member, I think one must understand, as Jesse has said, that the National Skills Fund was operating on the basic accounting system, which is a CAS system. Now, there was entanglement, if I can use that word, between the National Skills Fund transactions going through that and the departmental transactions going through that. And we then decided that we will create their own VAT. And we applied to Treasury, we approved it, and since the 1st of April 2007, they've been running on their own VAT, separate VAT, so there's no more contamination. And these adjustments, I think, mostly arose from the contamination that took place, where it became difficult to identify what is gold and what is National Skills Fund. But that is now resolved, and I think the Auditor General will concur with that, hopefully.
Well, I would expect that people who work for the National Skills Fund to advance the skilling of the nation, they must be skilled themselves. that more or less the explanation.
Thank you. The separation of the bank account did simplify the matter, but for the year under review, the majority of these adjustments were not as a result of that. It was basically as a result of NSF transactions that were not correctly recorded. I think there is an element of skill in it, and it's mostly supervision and monitoring of the financial status before it's submitted for audit.
So we're bringing the old card for monitoring, supervision, management function. I think
thank you, Celestepov. Let's now talk to matters of governance. That's page 153, paragraph 14. The observation is that policies and procedures contained in the operational manuals for certain funding windows and their sub-projects are in draft format and they have not been approved for the past 6 months. And there are also no operational manuals for several funding windows and their sub-projects. Now the question would be, what is the reason for the above? Is it capacity in terms of human resources, or is it capacity, is it skills capacity that these are not in place? Thank you.
Chairperson, all these operational manuals have now been approved. All of them except one has been submitted to the Auditor General's office. The last one has also been approved and will now be submitted to the Auditor General's office.
Good progress, but why has it taken 6 years?
Well, Chairperson, I can't explain that.
Somebody should be able to explain that.
It is not acceptable. I mean, when you implement a law, regulations must be placed so that the law can be implemented. But similarly here, when this was coming into operation, the operational manual should have been available from day one, because that then facilitates the implementation. That is how it should be.
You see, then it takes us back to the first question that the Honorable Matikiza asked around, your supply chain processes, your bidding, your this and that. So it says that the procedures that your colleague there was referring to, it was actually these procedures that were in draft format. So, but anyway, we're happy that those have been finalized and we'll now be operating on the basis of completed processes. But it took us 6 years. So it means in that 6 years, it was just that. And it was free for some. Free for some. Not for all.
Thank you, Chair. Now, urging DG, you are accused of non-compliance with the prescript as the operational manuals. With regards to Manpower Development Authority of Mopotetswan, I'd like you to hear your comment on that. And your comment should include, what are you doing to correct this situation? Mandap. Thank you.
Chairperson, with Mandap, the regulations were amended to transfer the funds to the social development funding window, and the funds that are committed under the Mandap arrangement have already been disclosed on the financial statements for 5 and 6, and it will continue to be disclosed in the financial statements of the NSF. And the uncommitted funds have been transferred to the social development funding window, so that we can now deal with it within that window, also using the operational manual that has just been completed for that funding window.
All right, thank you. And this Manpower Authority of Putatwan, for how long will it remain Putatwan? I mean, really?
Chairperson, it's no more there. We've transferred those funds now to the Social Development Funding Window, so there shouldn't be a mandate
anymore. it won't be there anymore.
It was just a transition phase difference in the...
Yeah, no, what I'm saying is that we've finished the transition.
Yeah, it's history now.
Okay. No, that's fine. That's okay. That's okay. All right. Except that, you see, acting teacher, my main concern, going back to the first question, you know, if I have my figures right, the social funding window disperses over around a quarter of a billion rand. And if these disbursements are done in an environment where there is less, there is no strict monitoring, it raises the question that the Honorable Madikiza asked at the beginning. Can we be assured that all these transactions were done free of corrupt practices? That's why when you said free for all, I said no, free for some. Because in a corrupt environment, it is only those who are meant to benefit from you. And I think from where we're standing, it's only correct for us to be skeptical. Otherwise, we cannot do any oversight work appropriately. And I'm just saying that you know, it raises a lot of concerns. A lot of money being dispersed, and it is supposed to assist, again, those people right at the bottom end of the ladder. And we find that the way they are being administered does not give comfort that it is ultimately those people who benefit, and they benefit appropriately. Now, for us who are here in Parliament, our entire involvement, which is supposed to assist those of other members in terms of our political process and what we seek to achieve, then gets defeated. So I hope that there will be new impetus, you know, in really tightening up the screws, especially, not necessarily limited to those areas that, you know, we spoke about the compensation funds. Now we're talking about maybe real control so that our people could benefit.
Thank you, Chair. Now I'm talking to internal audit. We note with concern that the internal audit planning process and conclusions on audit were performed by the internal audit was not sufficiently documented as required. Now one asks the question, what would be the reason for this shortfall? Once again, is it HR or skills capacity or lack of commitment and monitoring? Thank you.
Chairperson, the issues raised by the Auditor General regarding the execution of the internal audit were addressed during the planning of the internal audit for this financial year 2007 and 2008, and the Auditor General also indicated that for this financial year they will place reliance on the work of the internal audit. So I think there has been a satisfactory movement there, whereas previously they didn't place reliance on the internal audit, but this time they will. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thanks, acting DG, I can see the audit, auditors nodding across there. Now, I'd like to end my session with a general remark, but for all those issues that we addressed, be it qualification, emphasis of merit, and other matters, they have more to do with the management, supervision, and monitoring. They all have to do with the human factor. So I would like them to request you to look into the human factor, so that you effect effective monitoring. Managers must manage, supervisors must supervise. Thank you.
Yes, Chairperson, as I indicated earlier, we are going to have a session with all the managers to inculcate in them the responsibility to manage, which includes matters like this. And we will draw in particular to their attention the issues that have arisen during the last audit and even during the course of this audit. Because there, as you say, there is the human factor, there is the human element, but managers must live up to their responsibilities and obligations. That is why they're managers. So this is an issue that we are seriously addressing and will address going forward. Thank you.
Honourable friend?
Yes. The acting DC has sort of...
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You are done.
No.
You are not. All right. Okay. Yes. Oh, okay.
Thank you, Chair. This has to do with the vacancies and underspending. Currently, I'm taking DG. You're standing with regards to vacancies at 13.4%. What are you doing to enhance your recruiting effort? And such solution is your shortfall of 13.4% vacancies. What impact has it had on your performance, your functioning? Thank you.
Chairperson, I think I have in the previous session dealt with the issue of the vacancies, the process that we have undertaken to verify the establishment, to verify the vacancies that exist, and also to look at whether all those vacancies should be filled or whether some of those posts should be abolished, because there was a process of creation of posts but not filled. Now, if it's been created a year ago, it's not been filled by now, then maybe we don't need it. So we are looking at that, and as I indicated, we hope to conclude that process by the end of March, so that we really make sure that we have the requisite resources to deliver the services that we are required to deliver. Thank you.
With regard to understanding, the observation by the AG's office is that mainly the underspendings are attributable to furniture and equipment for the new employees that was not purchased. Now, the logical question would be, how do you employ a person and not empower him in terms of the tools of the trade? How do you expect that person to operate at optimum if they are not given furniture and other equipment that they would use?
Yeah, Chairperson, I don't know all of the details of that, but it is not that people do not have furniture. You sometimes find that people do have furniture, but they find the furniture too old and they want new ones. Now, sometimes when someone comes with a requisition to buy furniture, and we look at what he or she has available, we say there's no need to buy new furniture.
But I think,
we have stopped people from buying furniture when there was furniture available.
Yeah, I think the absence of details, I think that creates a tricky situation. because indeed, if you don't buy new furniture because you're the new employee, but then I think what it means, or the point it's raising, is that you had budgeted, you had a budget for it, and then it was not used. So it might as well be that it's either indeed the requisite tools of trade were not provided for some of the employees, or it might have been that it is a result of poor budgeting. Budgeted for things that we found out after budgeting that actually we don't need to buy those things. So let's hope it is the latter, because then it can be rectified, than if it is that
indeed there was need for truth of trade to be bought, but somehow the system was so slow or clogged that people ended up not, you know, being capacitated. What do you?
Thank you, General. I'm done. I rest my case now.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yes, Honorable Chen.
Honorable Marikis has done a very good job of the question, but there's just one response I've got from the acting DG which did concern me, and I want to be sure I understood what you said. You said that when government or parliament introduces new laws which entirely sets responsibilities on the administration, they should have at the same time they should produce all the manuals and whatever so that we don't get into these problems. Is that more or less what you said?
As I said, normally if the law requires that there be regulations made, yes, it is desirable that those are coming into operation together so that you don't have a vacuum.
Sure, now if it's regulations, then I'm happy, but is a manual a regulation?
Now,
I'll tell you why I want to say this.
Let me assist you.
I want to ask my question.
I thought that was your question.
No.
You see, what the acting DG was saying, he was actually agreeing with the auditors that he believes that when the law comes into operation, those manuals should have been done and completed. So there is no conflict between what was supposed to have happened and what he's saying. He's actually saying, yes, those things should have been done. But anyway, ask your question. I don't want it to be clear.
I've got to be really clear. If the law says that regulations must be made, that is the Treasury's responsibility. Absolutely. The Treasury that we read it. I'm talking about manual care, and I can't quite that. A former member of this committee said to us here once, and I've never got a very good point back. He said, you know, managers are paid and appointed to manage, not to be spoon-fed by Treasury. Now, when I read the PFMA, it says the following. The accounting officer of a department, entity, etc. must ensure that the department, trading entity, or financial institution has and maintains effective, efficient, transparent systems and all of the rest. That's what it is. It doesn't say that Treasury must provide that information and those guidelines. Treasury do it. Yeah, they do it because that is the way we work in practice, and that we come down that and we see that's an excellent idea. That's why they bring out this manual on performance information. But here, the ultimate problem, we can't have accounting officers blaming the fact that the Treasury hasn't given them a manual out to perform the job that they actually want to do. I think this is a big careful to do, and I'm not blaming Mr. Kettle because he's just, you know, haven't been in the job a long time.
Alright.
But I just think that we should be cautious on that.
Okay.
The acting CEO actually said that the managers are managed.
Honorable Chair. No, acting DG, just hold it there. I understood you very, very well. And I was trying to explain to my honorable colleague that what you were saying was actually not in contradiction with what he is also saying. You actually agree with him. So I think we have no contradiction. We actually are in agreement. So let's move on. Thank you, Honorable Trent. Yes, Comrade. Right, a short on the skills fund, and then we're coming over to you.
Yeah.
Just a minute. Let's continue. Yeah.
Sorry, Nombula, for that. Just for clarity, I just want to make sure on page 173 of the annual report, item 19 there, accounts receivables. At the bottom of page 173, accounts receivable. for 2005 and 6, the bottom one, the outstanding levy income was for 2005 and 6 was 86 million something. And then in 2006 and 7 is 191 million outstanding. And it's going to asterisk, it says here at the right at the bottom, the outstanding levies for the previous year were for 1 month, while the amount for the current year is 2 months. Now, I'd just like to get clarity why. Why did you use 1 month outstanding in 1 year, 2 months this year, maybe 3 months next year? I need to get some clarity on this. Thank you.
Yeah, no, I think, Chair, in the main, it has to do with the natural lagging of the transfer of the money, because the monthly levy as it's collected, there is a lag period between collection and, for example, for this month, the money will only flow in within, I think it's a prescribed date in the Levies Act by which SARS must have. So I think what most probably could have happened between for the 2 months period, there might have been a delay in terms of in the March, sorry, the February, because usually the lag at the end of the financial year is for the last month, the March one. So in that case of the 2067, there might have been a problem in terms of timely transfer of the money of February also from SARS.
Okay, thanks. Yes, Kumar.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'm going to be as brief as possible. The first question that I have, Chair, is that the procedure on implementation of supply chain management procurement has not been followed by sheltered employment, what do you call the factories, on an amount of 4.372 million. So can you explain what has been done to improve the non-compliance of that? Also that there will be no repetition on the weaknesses of implementation of national treasury regulation.
Yes, Chairperson, this matter is being addressed, and a composite advertisement is now being developed for publishing in the major newspapers, inviting prospective suppliers to register on the Sheltered Employment Factory Supplier Database in order to ensure that competitive bids are invited.
In the first instance, why was there no compliance? I mean, I hear the part around the correction, what is going to be done, but why did it have to happen in the first place?
I have the acting CEO of the Sheltered Employment Factory here, Chairperson.
No, please, let him respond.
Historical situation of it.
Okay.
Chairperson, the finding essentially revolves around the procurement of two major raw materials, South African Bureau of Standards fabric and Saligno wood. Those are the two major bits. There are limited numbers of suppliers of the former. For example, there are three mills in the textile mills in South Africa that supply SABS approved fabrics. We, in fact, get on an annual basis competitive quotes from the three suppliers. But in making our purchase, most of the procurement is above the threshold of 200,000 rand. And what I omitted to do was to apply to the accounting officer in terms of the Treasury Regulation 16A 6.4.
Why did you omit to apply?
In my own case, not sufficient knowledge. That has now been corrected, and that submission is in fact current.
It raises concerns that there might be other insufficient knowledge that we have on other matters that are going to crop up as we move along. I think these are basic basic things that do not have to occur. That's my worry. We're failing at the very, very elementary level. Yes, yes, comrade.
But also, the sheltered employment sectors, there is no valid transport contract at the moment with it, and there is an amount of 6.795 million that has been utilized. I just wanted to find out whether there is a process of a tender process of appointing a transport contractor.
Thank you, Chairperson. The specification for the transport service was compiled, and tenders have been advertised in the government tender bulletin. Bids have been evaluated, and a decision to award the contract will to be fully operational by March this year is to be made soon. So it has been advertised for inviting bids to the government tender.
But you see, Acting DG, it invites the same question. Why did it happen in the first instance? I hear that it's been corrected, which is okay, but why did it happen in the first instance?
Chairperson, there was a problem in which the previous contract was awarded, and this is one of the issues that constituted a charge against the former manager.
All right.
For which he subsequently dismissed and
okay.
Was appealed against.
All right.
In the report, Chairperson, page 126, paragraph 10. We've noted that the impairment test for all assets within the organization was not completed as required by the accounting standards. Also, there was insufficient monitoring relating to accounting records of inventory in transit at year end. Can you please indicate what action has been taken in appointing skilled officials to prevent these issues reoccurring?
Chairperson, on the fixed assets issue, the management committee of the Shelter Employment Sectors have instituted a special project to create a credible and accurate asset register to reconcile and verify the location and value of the assets, and to determine what assets would need to be written off as obsolete or redundant. And the progress to date is that asset registers are complete and assets have been barcoded. Physical verification of the assets have been completed at all the 12 factories. A policy is in place, and factory managers are to reconcile assets on a quarterly basis and institute corrective action if anomalies are identified. The assets to be impaired have been identified, and the authority to write them off is being addressed. This authority will be obtained before the 31st of March, and the assets will be disposed of appropriately. And finally, the revaluation of the assets has commenced and will be disclosed in the annual financial statement for the year ended 31st March this year. That's the progress that has been made in that matter.
So on paragraph 14, page 127, it is clearly indicated that there are misstatements identified during the audit. What progress has been made to ensure that only skilled officials are appointed to avoid the occurrence?
I'm
taking
the
question. I'm saying on paragraph 14, page 127. It is clearly indicated that there are misstatements identified during the audit. I just wanted to find out what progress has been made to ensure that only skilled officials are doing this type of work for us not to repeat what has happened.
We, in fact, have undergone a tremendous skills development exercise to ensure that particularly in amongst our people in supply chain management and in finance are actually capable of doing the job and carrying out the tasks that are required. Certainly in terms of some of the material corrections that were required in the previous financial statements, a part of that was as a result of management having considered that certain leases, which we accounted for in terms of being operational leases, as it turned out, the AG rather insisted that these be financial leases, and that had a tremendous impact on depreciation on the assets and so on. So that has been attended to, and we now, first of all, are fully GAAP compliant, and we're accounting for the leases accordingly.
The last question, Chairperson, is the non-compliance of applicable legislation, which is on page 1-7. It has been noted that there's a non-compliance with legislation, which was also reported in the previous financial year. The issue and concern is that for how long is it going to continue? If it was reported last year, why hasn't it been rectified?
Yeah, the one on it deals with the medical scheme and the business of a medical scheme. The action that we have taken there is to seek exemption from the Medical Schemes Act, in particular Section H. That exemption is being sought from the Council for Medical Schemes, and we are awaiting their response because an exemption is permitted in this case. So we are awaiting the response from the Council for Medical Schemes for that exemption. Thank you.
It's not only about medical schemes, but the federal regulations that were not followed, the Public Finance Management Act. If you see on page 128, that is where the Auditor General is indicating these matters were also reported in previous financial year. It's not just one issue.
Chairperson, the factories have never insured any of the assets since it's understood that it is government policy, and the Department of Labor in its relationship with the self-employment has confirmed that. But there are measures in place to safeguard the assets that include the proper warehousing of it, the security of the premises and assets, and proactive management to monitor and control in this regard. So we believe that it is not practice to ensure that government policy that is treated in this way.
Right. Thank you very much. Right, Comrade Pierre, and then Honorable Trent, and then we bring the matter to a close.
Thank you, Chair. On page 127, the previous issue, item 14, obsolete stock that has been written off amounting to 1.39 million. Could you just tell me what is this obsolete stock?
Honourable Member, the over a period of many, many years, probably going back 15 or so years, various bits of fabric and also goods that were actually manufactured from different types of fabric have built up as a result of provinces changing logos, hospitals becoming insistent that their specific logos are woven into a particular type of fabric. So we ended up with bolts of stuff and goods that had been made from them that were no longer required by state hospitals in this particular instance. In fact, the vast majority of this obsolete stock happens to be textile-type materials. We have now got the approval to get rid of those. The difficulty is how to do that, because these things have got RSA logos on them. In certain instances, prison uniforms that wear the correctional services have changed colour from the old olive drab to orange. It's what to do with that, and we're actually trying to handle that right now.
Thank you, Jim. My last question is just regarding the resolution that we had last year, SCOPA resolution. Certain issues haven't been resolved, and one of the issues that hasn't been resolved is the vacant post of the head of finance. Has there been any movement on this, because it's been vacant for 2 years?
It has not been resolved. Well, first of all, an appointment hasn't been made. We've been in the interim using external consultants to assist us and to take us through the whole process. Approval has been given, obviously, for the appointment of appropriate individuals, not only in finance but in other functions as well. This has been budgeted for in the new financial year, and it's hoped that this will be attended to very, very early in the new financial year.
Honourable Trent.
Honourable Member, our system at the time of the stock of the year-end closure last year, it was such that we accounted for inventory, this is finished goods stuff, that was already in stores and was in transit but not yet dispatched or invoiced to the customer. So the system, the accounting system, actually had all that as one in one big basket. And obviously it was very, very difficult then to convince the Auditor General that we knew exactly where all this stuff was. The error has been identified, or rather the system has been now modified, and we now have a properly instituted and auditable set of records as to what's in stock, what's in transit, what's been invoiced, and so on. It has been completed and attended to.
Honourable Trent, can you pull the mic?
Sorry, yeah. There are a number of SCOPA resolutions which haven't been resolved. I don't know whether we should just check on those, because obviously we would like to see if what we do in Parliament actually solicits a response. And but one or two of them are quite important. The one was the lack of knowledge by key staff members about relevant prescripts, laws, and regulations. And it says not resolved, and the Auditor General on being interrogated around that said that you still need assistance to compile your financial statements. So that's obviously not been resolved. The vacant post of head of finance had not been resolved at that point in time. And then your internal audit findings to be submitted and reviewed by the audit committee. They did not place any reliance on that. And that too also has not been resolved.
We touched on the head of finance, which is being resolved. As far as the requisite skills and knowledge about the various prescripts is being addressed constantly. We've in fact gone into a tremendous effort and focus on making sure, particularly as I say, in procurement, supply chain management, inventory management, and finance, that people actually understand what all the requirements are. It has been quite a traumatic time in converting from aligning for the very first time to SA GOF, Generally Accepted Accounting Practices, and that we did require external assistance for, and will require at this financial year end as we're attempting now. But I need to still make that motivation and request to the DG for continuation of using external resources.
The AG says that you have not yet listed yourselves as a departmental agency with a trading account. That might just be a technical thing, but I think it's important that we get an answer on that.
Yeah, it's worth bringing it, not just a technical issue. Chairperson, that process is underway
we have been advised by Treasury that they, in fact they could assist us in the business case process, in developing a business case for a trading entity. So we are formalizing that request to them. They've given us that advice. We think we should take that up. They have a technical assistance unit that would assist us in developing that business case so that we can have the entity be listed as a trading entity.
She can identify the problem.
and
I hope that's the last problem.
We find that the report resolution, the tax resolutions, we interact with the different entities and we do it in a positive spirit to try and, you know, Parliament then adopts usually our resolutions and then that's the last we hear of it until the Auditor General tells us next year what you've done and what you haven't done. You know, we really would like you to, do you look at the resolutions that come out of Parliament and actually respond to them directly, or don't you? To us, or to Parliament?
No, Jefferson, we have responded to the resolution in September last year, and we have also responded to the resolution at the table of the 13th of November. We deposited that response at Parliament on the 11th of January this year, as we were required to do within 60 days. So we do respond to the resolutions. We take them seriously.
All right. Thanks very much to the acting DG and your officials, and to the officials from Treasury, the Auditor General's office, and to my colleagues and our two comrades from the Portfolio Committee. Well, I think the long and the short of it, like I said at the beginning, that in our continuous interaction, yes, there are issues that we're happy have been resolved, there is movement. We just want to say let's add pace so that we reach our destination. We mustn't be in continuous movement forever. And like we said to Sandy, let it not be one step forward, two steps back. Let's continuously move forward. But to say that the essence of the AG's finding in our own reading of the annual report is the importance of monitoring and supervision. I think that is the key to the challenges that that has been identified by the AG's office. The centrality of the human factor. It's very important. Very, very important to ensure that there is proper monitoring, there's proper supervision. We're saying the TFMA has been promulgated to ensure that managers manage. But I think the challenge is that we don't think that managers are managing sufficiently. They can do better, and actually must do better if we're to get these things right. They are not insurmountable. So, wish you all of the best, and hope that you will not be acting for forever, because the reality of this human factor again is that for as long as a person is acting, somehow, I don't know whether it's practical or psychological, there is no sense of being effectively in charge. So we will not want to perpetuate a situation of perpetual acting. And I hope the Portfolio Committee can continuously query around this matter on an ongoing basis. There has to be finality, or this is a permanency on your position so that you can effectively ensure that the department is run appropriately. So that if next year we come here and still talk around people don't manage, there's no monitoring, there's no control activities, then we'll know where the blame lies. But of course, if things go well, we'll also know where the praise is due and direct it accordingly. But thanks very much. Comrades, we should, of course, together with the auditors, have a short meeting at V8, including Comrade Ngaleka and Kong. We need you for a short encounter at V8, the old assembly. Immediately we dispatch from here. Thank you very much.